would bring pleasure. Emo rock operas probably take a very long time to write and rehearse, so the utilitarian likely concludes that the immediate happiness created by allowing more people to, you know, eat, is still the right move. Suddenly, what seemed like a straightforward distribution model gets all gunked up. It's unlikely, absent other factors, that giving one-tenth of our available food to some James Cameron-worshipping Fallout Boy superfan is ethically preferable. But if we're being good little utilitarians, we have to go through the process of thinking it all through and recalculating, which is difficult and annoying. If you want to go down another utilitarian thought experiment rabbit hole, imagine if the dude weren't some amateur emo opera composer, but were instead a farmer who himself grew food that he could then give to others, or a doctor who made vaccines, or a climatologist working on a plan to reverse global warming and thus prevent more hurricanes in the future. Should she get more food? Those answers I will leave to the reader to decipher on her own. This, by the way, is a classic philosophy trick. You just lob a huge question out there, and then you say, "I leave it to the reader to determine the answers on her own." Philosophy teachers do this all the time. I personally think it's totally unfair and a complete abdication of their responsibility as educators. So why do they do it then? Well, the answer to that I will leave to the reader to determine. Consequentialism has recently seen a resurgence in the world of moral philosophy. This may be due to something endemic to the modern world, like income disparity hitting all-time highs, which has refocused academic attention on the misappropriation of capital. Or maybe the world's problems have just become so massive, the population so enormous, and the questions of how we treat each other so urgent, a philosophy that simply aims to help as many needy people as much as we can makes more sense in moral terms than it did in simpler, less populous times. Quite literally, as I write this, governments everywhere are deciding how to administer the various COVID-19 vaccines, which, at least at first, are in limited supply. Those calculations are indisputably utilitarian. They prioritize those most likely to get very ill or die, as well as people whose jobs put them at higher risk. So the good of each dose is therefore maximized because each one alleviates the most potential pain and unhappiness. We would be hard-pressed to find a school of philosophy that could describe a better way to vaccinate the public against this disease. While a purely results-based philosophy can create a lot of problems, there are clearly situations that greatly benefit from caring only about how much pleasure we can create and how little pain. Still making the jokes in my head. Can't stop, won't stop. But we also saw that determining the moral value of our actions based solely on the results can be impossible, or misleading, or hard to calculate, or all three. So, what if we ignore the results? What if we can determine the moral worth of what we do before we do it? What if, faced with a choice between killing one person or five, there was some kind of rule we could follow that would guarantee we acted correctly regardless of the result? And what if we could go back to that universe goodness accountant from the introduction who tisk-tisked us for all the bad results we got, and we could say to her, "Hey, lady, we don't care if our day of good deeds got all screwed up because we meant to do good things and only our intentions determine our moral worth." Wouldn't that feel good to rub it in her face a little? Well, buckle up, people. It's Kant time.
Chapter 3. Should I lie and tell my friend I'd like her ugly shirt?
Which of these false excuses have you used in order to avoid an annoying social obligation?
Sorry, I didn't get your text. My phone's been weird lately.
Ugh, I can't make dinner tonight. Our babysitter dropped out at the last second.
I would love to attend your daughter's middle school orchestra concert, but my lizard is depressed. She isn't sitting on her favorite rock, she won't eat lettuce, and I just need to be there for her.
That's not verbatim, but a girl once told me something very similar when I asked her out on a date in ninth grade, and it took me like a week to realize that it was probably not 100% true. Should I tell the truth is one of the most common ethical dilemmas we face. Most of us don't enjoy misleading people, but the gears of society do mesh more smoothly if we grease them with white lies. It certainly seems easier, and maybe even more polite, to tell someone we have to look after our sick lizard rather than saying, "I do not want to go to your kid's concert because it will probably suck and be boring," or worse yet, actually going to the concert. However, we also sense that there must be some ethical cost when we lie. We know we're not supposed to do it, and every time we do, we feel a twinge of wrongness. It feels bad, or at least iffy. But that feeling usually fades quickly, we just go about our lives, and in most cases, no one seems the worse for wear. So, is it actually bad? When we're first confronted with one of these situations, like a friend bought an ugly shirt to wear to a job interview and asked us for our opinion, we might do a couple of consequentialist calculations. Here are some good things about lying and saying we like the shirt. 1, we don't hurt our friend's feelings. 2, in fact, we make her happy. 3, we don't seem like a jerk. And 4, our friendship continues apace. Here are some bad things about telling the truth and saying that the shirt is hideous. 1, we make our friend sad. 2, we may have to have a difficult conversation and argue that true friendship means always being honest, which can be a tough sell when someone is upset at you for being honest. 3, we seem like a jerk. 4, our friend may react badly, double down on her own opinion in order to prove us wrong, wear the ugly shirt to the interview, fail to get the job because the interviewer questions the decision-making ability of someone who would buy such an ugly shirt, fall into a deep depression, sever ties with her friends and family, turn to a life of violent crime, and spend 25 years in a maximum security prison. Admittedly, that is a worst-case scenario. If we're being good little consequentialists, we might also try to anticipate the larger, broader set of consequences. What will be the effect of living in a world where our closest friends don't always tell us the truth? We may then conclude, correctly, that such a world already exists, and it's not so bad, really, so maybe we should just avoid any conflict and proclaim that the lace collar really pops and the oversized neon green buttons are a cool conversation starter. But as we've seen, consequentialist accounting is fuzzy and imprecise. Not to mention that this experiment seems a bit tainted because the benefits we've identified are largely to ourselves. We will either avoid some pain if we lie, the tough conversation with our friend, which might hurt her feelings, or we'll feel that pain if we tell the truth. And since people generally try to avoid pain whenever possible, our judgment may be a little skewed here. Generally speaking, the best ethical decision is probably not "let's take the easy route out of self-interest." It would be awesome if it were, but it's probably not. We should also acknowledge here that when we made those consequentialist calculations, we only went halfway. We thought about the good and pleasure that comes from lying, and the bad and pain that comes from telling the truth. But we did not try to calculate the good and pleasure that comes from telling the truth, or the bad and pain that comes from lying. We don't think about those sides of the equation so much because they're more nebulous. How do we calculate the societal benefit of truth, or the societal ill of a white lie? It only seems possible if something tangible results from those actions. Say, if we falsely proclaim that we like the ugly shirt and our friend, brimming with confidence from our compliment, wears it to the interview, doesn't get the job because of how ugly the shirt is, falls into a deep depression, turns to a life of violent crime, and ends up spending 25 years in a maximum security prison. Admittedly, that is another worst-case scenario. There's a whole bunch of what-ifs involved with ethical calculations, which is partly what makes utilitarian accounting feel shaky. So maybe there's some other ethical system we can use, one that promises hard and fast rules we can follow that will guarantee moral success. Perhaps what we need here is a real stickler. A stern hard-ass who crosses his arms disapprovingly when we equivocate. A no-nonsense Germanic dad who will look at our moral report card, see 5 A's and 1 A-, and ask us, what happened with the A-. We need Immanuel Kant and the philosophical theory known as deontology. The categorical imperative, the most German idea ever. Deontology is the study of duties or obligations. If you've heard the term before, you either A, studied philosophy, or B, had a very annoying conversation at a cocktail party with a grad student, probably named Jonas, who drank Japanese whiskey and talked way too much about David Foster Wallace. I love David Foster Wallace, but even I'm annoyed by how much I talked about him from 1995 to, like, March of last year. Immanuel Kant, primarily responsible for bringing deontology to prominence, believed that we should discern rules for moral behavior using only our ability for pure reasoning, and then act out of an unflinching duty to follow those rules. Some situation presents itself, we tease out the specific maxim or rule we have to follow, we follow it, and we're done. Since the only thing that matters is our adherence to the duty to follow whatever rule we came up with, the results of our actions are irrelevant. Following the right rules is acting morally. Not following them is failing to act morally. End of story. No leeway, no loopholes, no excuses. It's a pretty rigid system, and as you might expect, Kant was a pretty rigid dude. As legend has it, his routines were so predictable and exact that local shopkeepers in East Prussia would set their watches based on when he walked past their stores. That's most likely an apocryphal story, but it speaks to the myth that built up around him based on his hardcore view of morality and his scholarship in general. I mean, anyone who built an entire ethical theory on the back of pure reason is bound to be an intensely scholarly fellow. Before he delved into moral philosophy, he was a lover of history and science, as Bertrand Russell tells us.
After the earthquake of Lisbon, he wrote on the theory of earthquakes. He wrote a treatise on wind, and a short essay on the question whether the west wind in Europe is moist because it has crossed the Atlantic Ocean.
There isn't a ton of humor to be found in the writings of 18th century philosophers, but honestly, nothing is funnier to me than imagining Immanuel Kant's treatise on wind. I mean, picture the most boring text you can imagine, the 1976 Caldwell, Idaho Business Registry, or a 900-page history of the garden hose. I guarantee you, they are not one-tenth as boring as Immanuel Kant's treatise on wind. But once he moved past his fascination with, you know, air that moves around, he focused his considerable intellect on morality, and even today is held in extremely high regard among Western philosophers, probably because none of them ever had to read his treatise on wind. Kant's explication of deontology is famously difficult to read. It's much harder, I think, than utilitarianism or Aristotelian virtue ethics. For me, Kant isn't as hard to read as some, like Georg Hegel, gave up after 2 minutes, or that fascist Heidegger, but it's still hard, and I would recommend reading an annotated edition if you decide to dive in. This is also a good chance for me to plug the online Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which has very well-written and pretty clear explanations of just about everything that's ever happened in the field. And it's free. The Good Place writers used it all the time, whenever we got lost or needed a refresher course on something, which was very frequently. For the record, the hardest thing I've even attempted to read is Ludwig Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which, like, don't even try. Wittgenstein is largely thought of as a genius even by professional philosopher standards, and that 75-page-long migraine is the only book he ever published in his lifetime. Imagine being so brilliant that you only write one 75-page book, and the smartest people who ever lived are all like, man, that guy's a genius. Jeremy Bentham may have suffered from a creepy post-mortem scarecrow fantasy, but at least he included fun little poems in his ethical writings. Kant never composed any fun little poems. Kant's writing is the opposite of fun little poems. Kant's writing sounds like this.
A completely isolated metaphysics of morals is not only an indispensable substrate of all theoretically sound and definite knowledge of duties, it is also a desideratum of the highest importance to the actual fulfillment of its precepts.
I picked that chunk at random, but they're all like that. It is not a great beach read. However, The most important idea in Kantian ethics is fairly simple to understand. It's called the categorical imperative, which he introduced in his not at all intimidatingly titled Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals.
Act only according to that maxim, whereby you can, at the same time, will that it should become a universal law.
We need to really take that in, because it's arguably the most famous sentence in Western philosophical thought. The only others that would really come close would be René Descartes' Cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, Thomas Hobbes's The Life of Man is Solitary, Poor, Nasty, Brutish, and Short, and of course, the insane clown posse's Water, Fire, Air, and Dirt, Fucking Magnets, How Do They Work? The categorical imperative states that we can't just find rules that tell us how we ought to behave. We have to find rules that we could imagine everyone else following too. Before we do something, we have to determine what would happen if everyone did it. And if a world in which everyone did it would be all screwed up, that means we're not allowed to do it. So, should we lie to our friend? No, because first we have to imagine a world where everyone lies. And in such a world, we'd realize, no one would ever trust each other. Human communication would cease to function, all interactions would become suspect, and even lying, the thing that we're thinking about doing, would lose its point. So, we can't lie to anyone, ever, for any reason. See what I mean? This dude is hardcore. And when we tell the truth, we have to do so not, you know, because we care about our friend, or we're afraid we'll be caught in a lie or something. We tell the truth only out of a duty to follow the universal maxim we have reasoned out. Giving money to charity because, say, we feel sad about the state of the world, well, that might be a nice thing to do, but the action has no moral worth. It only has moral worth if we're adhering to a maxim, perhaps, when we are able, we ought to help those less fortunate, that we can imagine everyone in the world following. In order to be good little Kantians, our motivation in any action cannot stray one inch from acting out of a duty to follow a universal maxim. No exceptions. Basically, Kant wanted to differentiate between humans using their pure reason, thus confirming our specialness as the only creatures who can do that, and the rest of the beasts in the lower animal world, where emotions and feelings reign supreme and events unfold due to those baser passions. That's why things like happiness and fear have to be taken out of the equation when we're looking at motivations. I mean, you know, cows and porcupines can feel happiness or fear, and we've got to be better than some dumb porcupine munching on a twig. This explains why Kant thinks that giving to charity out of sympathy or sadness might be praiseworthy, but not moral. His esteem for the human ability to use our brains makes him a bit of a snob, and that snobbery puts him in good philosophical company. Most schools of thought, both ancient and modern, spend a decent amount of time extolling the most brilliant and educated among us, and affirming that humans are better than other creatures because we can think and reason and philosophize and they can't. Those arguments make perfect sense, until you see a bunch of kids on a speedboat during spring break chugging vodka from an ice luge shaped like a shotgun, and then you start to think, I don't know, maybe otters and butterflies have it more figured out than we do. But Kant's strict system also provides a form of comfort. Since moral success comes only from acting out of a duty to follow a universal maxim, if something bad happens as a result of whatever we do, it ain't on us, we acted correctly. In that sense, Kantian deontology is the exact opposite of utilitarianism. It seems important to note here that Kant and Bentham were roughly contemporary, and Kant entirely predates Mill. So it's slightly more accurate to say that utilitarianism was a response to deontology and not the other way around, even though we discussed utilitarianism first in this book. In that sense, Kantian deontology is the exact opposite of utilitarianism. For example, while all of utilitarian ethics was based on maximizing happiness, Kant thought happiness was irrelevant.
There can be no imperative which would, in the strict sense, command us to do what makes for happiness, because happiness is an ideal not of reason, but of imagination, depending only on empirical grounds, which one would expect in vain to determine an action through which the totality of consequences, which in fact is infinite, could be achieved.
That's how Kant explains my Hawaiian pizza and red hot chili peppers problem. There's no followable maxim involving the creation of happiness, because happiness is something subjective that we can only define for ourselves. Nothing in the world, no matter how simple, will make everyone happy. My own daughter, Ivy, doesn't like cake, and my son, William, doesn't like ice cream. So we can't possibly design a rule involving making people happy that we would want everyone to follow. What makes me happy will make someone else deeply sad or indifferent, or maybe happy but in a different way or to a different degree. So if Kant had written a fun little poem to explain his philosophy like Bentham did, it would look like this.
Act only out of duty to follow a universal maxim. Derive these maxims using your pure reason. Happiness is irrelevant. End of poem.
Not quite as catchy. Categorical Imperative 2, the rare sequel that's better than the original. So Kant doesn't care what you think of the world versus what I think of the world. He wants to take feeling and sentiment out of the equation. This is Kant's calling card, the insistence that morality is something we arrive at free of our subjective feelings or judgments. None of that Aristotelian trial and error or consequentialist happiness, sadness, guesswork. We have to use our rational brains, and only our rational brains, to create rational rules that lead to rational conclusions about rational actions. Now, whether you agree or not, Kant's hardcore brain-based theory was a seismic event in Western philosophy. His monumental influence can only be understood when you see how many contemporary philosophers worked from his source material. He's sort of like Alfred Hitchcock in film, or maybe Run DMC in hip-hop. He had a massive influence on all of those who came after him. But deontology also creates new problems for us. Chief among them, when we replace feeling and individual judgment with strict universal laws that we have to discern and then follow, it can take a very long time to figure out what the hell to do. Sometimes, behaving ethically can be a trust your gut type of exercise, and now here's Kant to tell us that our guts are stupid and we shouldn't listen to them. This is a frequent criticism of Kantian theory. Trying to obey it is a purely intellectual exercise, and it's really goddamn hard. The character Chidi Anagonye in The Good Place is a strict Kantian, and he's so concerned with formulating precise Kantian maxims that he essentially paralyzes himself with indecision, struggling to act in even the simplest of circumstances. At one point, Chidi is so desperate to avoid lying in order not to violate the categorical imperative that he struggles to lie to actual demons who want to destroy him and his friends. After suffering Chidi's tortured internal debates for the millionth time, Michael, Ted Danson's character, asks him this.
Has anyone ever told you what a drag you are?
And his reply is,
everyone. Constantly.
There are many other criticisms of Kant, however. One I personally like comes from 19th century German grump Friedrich Nietzsche, who found Kant overly moralistic and schoolmarmish.
Some moralists want to vent their power and creative whims on humanity. Some others, perhaps including Kant, suggest with their morality, what deserves respect in me is that I can obey, and you ought not to be different from me.
Or to paraphrase, ugh, get over yourself, Kant. The irony here, of course, is that Nietzsche and Kant certainly have a lot in common, not the least of which is that Nietzsche was an inveterate snob. His entire worldview is based on the idea that most people are weak and dumb, and a very small number are incredible and brilliant, and those people should be allowed to do essentially whatever they want. This is another case, like the Greeks celebrating wise men while they cleared their throats and pointed to themselves, of a philosopher essentially arguing that we ought to revere people who are suspiciously like the philosopher himself. Also, if you're scoring the philosophy fight between Kant and Nietzsche, at least Kant's snobbery didn't accidentally help create the Nazis. But there's a second formulation of the categorical imperative, sometimes in translation called the practical imperative. It adds a rule to Kant's philosophy that isn't nearly as difficult to follow.
Act so that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in that of another, always as an end and never as a means only.
In other words, don't use people to get what you want. Lying to our friend does just that. We're doing it in order to avoid a difficult conversation or in order to avoid seeming like a jerk. She's not an end in herself, she's a means to an end. This formulation of the categorical imperative also retroactively gives a new explanation as to why we felt so queasy about poor Steve, that ESPN engineer. If we let Steve get zapped so that we could watch the World Cup, we'd be literally using him as an object that absorbs pain so that we can experience pleasure. As technical and brainy as Kantian theory is, I find there to be something sweetly humanistic about the second formulation. Kant holds humans in the highest possible regard, and he rejects any action that demeans them or turns them into tools used to achieve some other goal. I'm not saying you'd want him to, like, be your dad and comfort you after you strike out in Little League, but I do think this iteration of the categorical imperative means there's a beating heart under all of that pure reason. Finding the right maxim, it's nearly impossible. So let's now look at the trolley problem through Kant's eyes. He, obviously, would reject the coarse utilitarian results-based calculation, kill one person because one is less than five. Since the results of an action are irrelevant, the "we saved four people" refrain bounces harmlessly off the imposing Germanic fortress of deontological theory. Kant only asks, when considering our options, what maxim could we will to be universal, and what action will obey our duty to follow it? Maybe we could reason out a maxim that says, we should always try to spare the lives of our fellow humans, which could certainly be universalized. The world in which everyone follows that rule seems like a pretty good world. So then, should we pull the lever? I mean, we'd save lives, but we would also be causing that one other worker to die, which seems to betray the maxim. So actually, hang on a second. Maybe we could design a different maxim that says we should never intentionally cause an innocent person to die. Again, easily universalized. And since pulling the lever does in fact cause a person to die, maybe we don't pull it. I mean, if we do nothing, we wouldn't be causing five people to die. The failed trolley brakes would cause that, right? But hang on, because maybe the second the brakes fail, the thing that's causing something to happen transfers from the trolley brakes to us, since we're the only ones with the ability to affect the trolley, which means doing nothing is actually us causing five people to die. But hang on again, because by pulling the lever, we would definitely be causing that one other guy to die, and he never would have died without us pulling the lever, and so how is that okay? In classic philosophy is impossible fashion, I have to make this an innocent person to avoid counterarguments about self-defense, and also Todd points me to something called just war theory, which is a collection of arguments about the specific set of criteria necessary to justify war, because in some extremely constrained circumstances, it turns out, killing an innocent person may in fact be permissible. Again, we're in one of those but, although, however spirals where you can't even say, hey, let's agree that there are things, before some philosopher raises her hand and points out 26 reasons where we can't actually declare that there are, in fact, things. Several times over the course of The Good Place, we had someone say to Chidi, this is why everyone hates moral philosophers. I never truly understood why that's funny until I began writing this book. See how hard this is? Even though Kant promises clear answers to moral problems, when you apply his reasoning to the trolley problem, it seems like we're in trouble. We're kind of always in trouble with Kant. He's always standing right behind us, clucking his tongue, pointing out how badly we're blowing it. Now, again, most situations are not as death-soaked as the trolley problem. Most situations are far more mundane, like, should we lie to our friend and say we like her ugly shirt? So we can more easily tease out the right Kantian move. But the trolley problem does reveal a lot of what is frustrating about deontological theory. These maxims take time to formulate, and acting out of a duty to follow them sometimes still seems wrong, and then we have to start over and come up with a new maxim. For better or worse, the strict utilitarian can just lightning quick say, five is more than one, and yank the lever. But the Kantians have to use their pure reason to draw up a universal rule and act only out of a duty to follow that rule. And in this instance, they have to do that while barreling down the tracks on a runaway trolley with screaming passengers and scared old ladies and the lives of six somehow still unaware of their impending doom construction workers at stake. How the hell are they going to pull that off in real time? I mean, we've been mulling this over for half an hour and we still don't have a clear answer for what we're supposed to do. But let's put practicality aside for a second. There must be some way to create a maxim we can follow that A, we could will to be universal, and B, leads to saving those five lives, which our guts kind of told us would be the better outcome. Remember, our intention is all that matters here. We just need a maxim that means we're intending only to save five people who would be smushed if we did nothing, which would mean that the smushing of the one other guy wouldn't be morally weighing on our shoulders because we didn't intend to smush him. So let's return to that maxim, we ought to spare the lives of innocent people whenever possible, but modify it slightly to say this: we ought to spare the lives of as many innocent people as we can whenever possible. Now, this is obviously sending us back toward utilitarian math. Put a pin in that, we'll return to it in a second. Since five innocent people are about to die, we conclude that the action that obeys our duty to that maxim is pull this lever. We can reasonably argue that we would have pulled that lever even if no one were on the other track, so if the result of following our maxim is one guy gets smushed, well, that sucks, but it was not our intention. Philippa Foot was actually addressing this exact point in her original paper. It has to do with something called the doctrine of double effect. It's a philosophical idea that goes all the way back to St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. Basically, it means that an outcome can be more or less morally permissible depending on whether you actually intended it to happen when you acted. Like when we kill someone in self-defense, we intended only to save our own innocent life, and the result was that someone else died. If we pull the lever intending to deliberately smush a guy, that's not so great. But if the guy got smushed because we were intending to save the lives of five guys, we're off the hook. Now, this may all seem like semantics, or worse yet, a loophole. But since intentions are all that matter to Kant, if we pull this off, we can maybe eat our cake and have it too, which means in this case, saving more lives and not disappointing Immanuel Kant. One aspect of Kantian reasoning actually makes the trolley problem clearer and not murkier. It helps to explain, even better than Bernard Williams's integrity argument, why our gut reactions to its different versions varied from example to example. Remember how most people feel like pulling the lever is okay, but shoving the weightlifter off the bridge is not? Until now, we could only explain this by saying, it feels wrong, or maybe our integrity has to matter. Those are decent explanations, but Kantian deontology gives us a much sharper knife, and now we can slice this bologna really thin. A second ago, I mentioned that we were drifting back toward utilitarian accounting by adding as many innocent lives as we can into our maxim, which feels like we're stirring some utilitarianism math into the deontological stew. We might wonder if utilitarianism and Kantianism kind of merge here. Why do we need the annoying, difficult-to-follow Kantian rulebook at all? Can't we just use the much easier to understand greatest happiness principle? This all goes back to that idea that sometimes, if we use utilitarian methods, we arrive at the right moral answer, but for the wrong reasons. Viewing the original trolley problem from a deontological standpoint, we decided to follow the maxim, we ought to spare the lives of as many innocent people as we can whenever possible. And the action we took out of a duty to follow that maxim was pulling a lever. Now, pulling a lever is a pretty neutral action. It isn't inherently wrong or bad to pull a lever. But in the shove a weightlifter off the bridge version, our action is certainly not neutral. We're just straight up murdering a dude. So while a duty to follow the maxim, we ought to spare the lives of as many innocent people as we can whenever possible, might seem like just a fancy way of a utilitarian saying five is more than one, that similarity completely dissolves when we add in the second formulation of the imperative, that we should not use people as a means to an end, but rather as ends in themselves. If we shove Don off a bridge, that certainly counts as using him as a means to an end. He would cease to be a person and literally become a tool, in this case a human trolley stopper, that allows us to achieve some other goal. In the trolley problem classic, utilitarian accounting and deontological duty overlap. Whichever one we use, we're likely to arrive at the same result, which is pull the lever and save the five people. But utilitarian accounting isn't as finely honed as Kantian reasoning. As the details of the problem shift and change, strict utilitarianism keeps telling us to just kill one and save five, even when we start to feel queasy about the way in which we're carrying out that kill one part. A philosopher named John Torek wrote a paper on this issue, essentially tearing utilitarianism a new one, called Should the Numbers Count? Now, Torek is flabbergasted at the notion that you would ever make a life or death decision based on how many people are on one side of the equation and how many are on the other. Because doing so, he says, ignores the fact that each person's life is maximally valuable to that person. And just mathematically adding the values of five lives together doesn't give you some kind of greater total value than the value of one life. He essentially argues that if you have a choice between saving a million lives with, say, a million doses of life-saving medicine, or one life by giving all million doses to one person who needs that much medicine to be cured, you should flip a coin. It's very intense. His dedication to this idea is admirable, but I kind of feel like it would be hard to give a million doses of medicine to one person while a million other people died. I also feel like if I were that one guy, I'd maybe think, yeah, go ahead and save a million people. Deontology, however, draws important lines of distinction between acceptable and unacceptable kill-one-person actions. Again, we should note that utilitarians might claim we're calculating wrong here, that living in a world where anyone could just be shoved off a bridge in order to stop a careening trolley would cause so much widespread psychic agony that the pain of doing it would outweigh the pleasure of saving more lives. But it's hard not to see that Kant's more meticulous playbook gives us a better and sturdier reason not to shove Don off that bridge. We can't even lie to murderers? Part of Kant's enduring appeal, it seems to me, is that he promises a foolproof how-to guide for living a moral life. He is telling us that we can, if we stick with his program, get an A on this test. But just like with the thought experiments designed to show the limits of utilitarianism, we can find some hypotheticals that seem to poke holes in deontology. Here's a fun one. The irony of this thought experiment, by the way, which seems to find a crucial flaw in deontological reasoning, is that it was written by Kant himself. It's what the kids would call a self-own. So here's the experiment. Let's say a murderer wants to kill your brother Jeff, who is hiding upstairs in your house. The murderer knocks on your door. He's a polite murderer. He doesn't just barge in. And he says, "Hello, I am a murderer. I am trying to kill your brother Jeff. Is he home, perchance?" Now, our natural inclination would be to say, "Sorry, polite murderer, he is not here." But remember, Kant tells us we are not allowed to lie, because lying can't be universalized, because if everybody could lie, it would render all human communication meaningless, etc., etc. And so, absurdly, Kant tells us we are not allowed to lie to a murderer even when he has flatly stated that he is there to murder our brother. If Kant is our guide, Jeff is doomed. Sorry, Jeff. I hope you understand. We just can't violate a universal maxim. Thanks for taking such good care of us all those years after Mom and Dad got divorced. Sorry you're going to be murdered. But maybe we can finagle a different maxim out of the situation, as we did with the trolley problem, and find a little escape hatch, which may in turn help us with that problem of our friend in her ugly shirt. What if we respond not with a lie, but with a true statement that doesn't help him find Jeff? What if we say, "You know, polite murderer, I saw my brother earlier today at the grocery store, and I know on Tuesdays he likes to go to the park and feed the ducks." If those statements are true, and we're good enough actors to hide our nervousness, and the murderer doesn't ask any follow-up questions, and Jeff doesn't step on a creaky spot of the upstairs floor at the exact wrong time, like in a horror movie, the murderer may go and check the duck pond instead of, you know, going upstairs and murdering our brother. This little hedge allows us to avoid disobeying a categorical imperative, and it also saves Jeff's life. Sometimes with Kant, it feels like a game where we have to find either the right way to phrase the maxim we will follow, or a way to avoid not following it in order to achieve the result we want without running afoul of his rules. Stuff like this is where Kant loses me, honestly. If a murderer is at our door trying to kill our brother, we don't really have a lot of time for adherence to universal maxims other than don't let anyone murder our brother. Of course, this is Kant's whole point, right? They're not universal maxims if you can pick and choose when to follow them. That's why they're not called mostly universal, but if you're in a tough scrape, they don't have to be totally universal maxims. Still, I just bristle at Kant for not allowing us to use our judgment here. It just doesn't feel very human. Aristotle, in contrast, allows us to seek virtue in a more experiential way, essentially by trial and error, which strikes me as more compassionate. It feels like he trusts us and has more tolerance for the mistakes that we're bound to make. Universally mandated duties are good in theory, but I kind of wonder how Kant would feel if he were hiding in the attic and the polite murderer came looking for him. Maybe he'd hope we had ignored his writings and read more Aristotle. Although he was so hardcore, he'd probably be perversely psyched to die because we followed a categorical imperative. In the case of our friend in the ugly shirt, then, we might find a way to be good little Kantians and still not cause our friend pain or sadness by just straight up saying, "That shirt is butt ugly." Now, ideally, of course, we have the kind of friendship where we can say, "Honestly, that's not your best look," and our friend will receive that comment with equanimity. But if our friend is more sensitive or more nervous about the interview, maybe we could say, "You know, I really like that blue shirt you have. You should wear that one." Or maybe we say that this interview is so important, we should go shopping and pick out a shirt she looks even better in. Or maybe, if we see that she really loves the shirt, and wearing it seems to be giving her confidence heading into this job interview, and we get the sense that her wearing the shirt isn't going to ruin her life or cause her any exquisite pain or suffering, we could simply say that we generally think she always looks good, and that if the interviewer has half a brain, she'll give our friend the job no matter what shirt she wears. With these first chapters, we have learned about the three main globs of secular ethical thought in the Western world over the last 2,400 years: Aristotelian virtue ethics, consequentialism, and deontology. But sometimes, in our everyday lives, we encounter some mundane little question about what we ought to do in some basic earthbound scenario, and we don't want to have to employ a huge, all-encompassing moral theory to make sense of what's right. We just want someone to tell us, quickly, what we should do. We want rules, like the ones Kant offers us, but, you know, simpler rules. Really, we just want someone to explain, for example, whether we should return our shopping cart to the rack by the grocery store entrance, or whether it's okay to leave it in the parking lot. Can someone just tell us whether we should do that, without a complicated universal maxim derived from pure reason or a multi-tiered hedon dolor utilitarian calculation? I mean, is that too much to ask?
Chapter 4. Do I have to return my shopping cart to the shopping cart rack thingy? I mean, it's all the way over there.
What's the smallest nice thing you do for other people on a regular basis? Not other people like your best friend or sister, but people you don't even know. The individual faceless dots comprising the mass of humanity that you're aware of but never really think about unless one of them talks too loud in a movie theater or throws a fit in a Jamba Juice because there's not enough mango in her smoothie. Maybe when you park on the street, you try to leave a full car length of space between your car and the car in front of you, so that someone else will also have a spot to park in, instead of an awkward half-spot length, which when you come upon it, boils your blood. Or maybe if you're walking on the street at night, and there's a woman walking alone a few yards ahead, you cross to the other side of the street so she doesn't have the unsettling sound of footsteps behind her. You do these things, maybe, because your grandfather taught you to be considerate, or because someone once did a similarly nice thing for you and it made you feel good. And when you do these things, these little basic other people things, you get a twinge of happiness. I'm a good person, you think. I did my good thing for the day. But what you didn't know is that all of those things are very bad. No, I'm just kidding. Of course they're good. Why would they be bad? They're warm-hearted and thoughtful and nice. I just thought it would be funny to make you sweat a little. I love these little kindnesses, the almost imperceptible improvements on the world that we live in, done solely for the benefit of other people. When I'm the recipient of these courtesies, when someone stops and waves me out in a moment where I have to take a difficult left turn across two lanes of traffic, say, I get disproportionately happy, because it means that the people around me are considering the lives and feelings of others, and I believe that consideration to be the glue that holds society together. And when the opposite occurs, when someone in rush hour decides to ignore the no left turn 4 to 7 p.m. sign and just sit there in the left lane waiting to turn down a side street, utterly disregarding the hundreds of cars grinding to a stop behind him because apparently his desire to make a left at this exact street is far more important than everyone else's desire to get wherever they're going combined, I dream of shooting fire from my eye sockets and melting his car into a puddle of smoldering metal. The thing about these nice little gestures is they're essentially free. We have to park somewhere, so why not park in such a way so as to allow for other people to park too? You have to walk somewhere, so why not relieve a fellow pedestrian's potential anxiety by popping over to the other side of the street and signaling that you're not a threat to her safety? These tiny decisions don't cost us anything except the ounce of thought needed to execute them, and they're helpful for other people. But what about when it isn't free? When it requires a little extra effort? What about, say, after we unload our groceries into our car and our empty shopping cart is sitting there in the parking lot and the cart rack is over there, 40 yards away, and we just want to get home? I mean, do we have to? Come on, be reasonable. When I began working on The Good Place, literally at square one of trying to figure out what made someone good or bad, I figured that learning the answers would be way easier if I had some actual philosophy experts to help me. Aristotle was right, it turns out. Everybody needs a teacher. So I emailed a UCLA professor named Pamela Hieronymy and asked her to meet me for coffee one afternoon, where I was hoping she could explain all of moral philosophy in a tight 90 minutes so I could beat the traffic. When I arrived, by the way, she just wasn't there. A whole hour went by. I emailed her and asked if I had gotten the date wrong, but it turned out that she was just so deeply lost in her own research and writing that she had completely forgotten about the meeting, which delighted me. I mean, that is exactly what you want out of your philosophical advisors. And now here's a hilariously passive-aggressive subnote from Todd.
Sorry about my prompt responses to your emails, Mike.
When I explained the show's premise to Pamela and asked her for some guidance, her first recommendation was that I read a book called What We Owe to Each Other by T.M. Scanlon. So I did. Well, more accurately, I read the first 90 pages, got lost, put it down, picked it back up a month later, got lost again, tried one more time, gave up, and I haven't looked at it since. But I feel like I got the gist, and Pamela explained it to me very thoroughly. Whatever, don't judge me. In the series finale of The Good Place, I had Eleanor finish reading the book after quite literally an eternity of trying. Scanlon calls his theory contractualism. Now, it's nowhere near as central to the history of philosophy as our big three, but its core tenet really appeals to me. It provides a reassuring ethical baseline, a kind of standardized universal rulebook that we can all thumb through for guidance as we wander around in the world bumping into people on the street and getting caught in awkward interactions at Jamba Juice. Scanlon's work comes out of Kantian rules-based ethics, but it isn't nearly as demanding. You know how when you buy something electronic, like a dishwasher or a Bluetooth speaker or something, there's a 300-page manual printed in like 50 different languages, and then there's a 2-page quick start guide that tells you the basics of just how to turn it on and plug it in and stuff? In rules-based ethics, Kant wrote that 300-page manual. Contractualism is the quick start guide. Now, while it's true that we can get a decent handle on Kant through his relatively pithy imperatives, he still requires us to use our pure reason to abstractly formulate these thorny universal maxims, which, as we've seen, can be tricky and time-consuming. For me, Scanlon's process for determining ethical rules is much easier to grasp and deploy. Hieronymy, who had been a student of Scanlon's at Harvard, described contractualism to me like this. Imagine that our crew has been at war with another crew for years, just slugging it out in a dense forest, firing on each other from trenches 100 feet apart. It is an absolute stalemate. Neither side has any advantage over the other, and no hope of ever gaining one. So, exhausted and weary, we call a temporary truce, and we decide we somehow need to design and describe a mutually livable society. We need a set of rules that can be accepted by both sides, no matter how wildly different our views are. And we obviously hold very different views, hence the endless trench warfare. So Scanlon's suggestion is this. We give everyone on both sides the power to veto every rule, and then we start pitching rules. Assuming that everyone is motivated to actually find some rules in the first place, that everyone is reasonable, the rules that pass are the ones that no one can reject. This means we'll all design our rules in such a way that they can be justified to the other people, because if we don't, then they won't become rules. It's a simple, elegant way of finding the basic bucket of societal goo that holds us together. Now, it makes a very big assumption that everyone is going to be reasonable. This is definitely one of those moments in philosophy where we have to back up and define something in order to feel like we know what the hell we're talking about. Now, Scanlon doesn't give a quick, pithy definition of reasonable, in part because there isn't one, but in essence, he says this: I am reasonable if, when you and I disagree, I am willing to constrain or modify my pursuit of my own interests to the same degree that you're willing to constrain or modify your pursuit of your interests. When we come together to suggest our rules, then, we aren't just looking out for number one, but instead we both want to design a world where we accommodate each other's needs, so that when we don't see eye to eye on something, finding a way to coexist in some kind of harmony becomes our top priority. Scanlon is after what he calls a shared willingness to modify our private demands in order to find a basis of justification that others also have reason to accept. It's sort of like a contract that he wants all of us to sign, giving us all the same exact motivations. Now, importantly, this doesn't mean that we always have to defer to other people in every conflict, because in Scanlon's world, they are approaching the conflict with the same intention to modify their interests in order to justify them to us. So it creates this kind of dynamic tension where we all regard everyone else's interests as equal to our own, not more important, but equally important. So we can now better understand why Hieronymy explained this to me by setting this scene of endless, miserable, stalemated war. Both sides' weariness and desire for a path forward help us believe that everyone will be reasonable, because we're all motivated to find a way out of this quagmire, and we all recognize that everyone else is motivated in the same way. Now, obviously, we might wonder what happens if some people are not reasonable. Simply, they don't get to weigh in. Pamela described two cases to me, the doormat and the asshole. When we pitch rules to the doormat, he agrees to everything because he undervalues his own interests. When we pitch rules to the asshole, she agrees to none of them because she overvalues her interests. So neither of these unreasonable people gets the chance to sit at this metaphorical table where we're coming up with our rules. And more important, if we're not at a metaphorical and imaginary table, but rather out in the real world interacting with real people, it can sometimes be up to us, when we encounter a person like this, to project reasonableness onto them. We can't take advantage of the doormat, for example, by realizing that he's just going to agree to whatever we propose and then proposing a bunch of rules that serve to benefit ourselves at his expense. Instead, we need to keep ourselves in check by recognizing that there's a disconnect between the way that these doormats and assholes are acting and the way that a reasonable person would be acting, and then only propose rules that they would follow if they were indeed reasonable. When we apply Scanlon's theory to the world we live in, this world comprising thousands of small moments and decisions and interactions, contractualism makes a pretty good divining rod for bad or unjust behavior. For example, if somebody proposed a rule that said, no driver should use the breakdown lanes on any highway unless there's an emergency, no one would reasonably reject that rule. This rule, properly applied, would treat everyone the same and serve public safety. Now, this is assuming the governing body treated all people the same. Traditionally not the case in most countries, but we're creating an imaginary and fair society here, so just go with me. If we were actually designing rules for our society, we'd probably want to start with some rules for the governing body itself, like no racism and all people have equal rights regardless of gender, and a bunch of other basic stuff that was left out of the founding documents of essentially every nation on Earth. But if Wayne the Lamborghini driver said,
hey, I got a rule. No one can use the breakdown lanes except for Lamborghini drivers who can drive wherever they want because Lambos rule!
Well, then someone could, and likely would, reasonably reject that rule. Scanlon's theory allows us to quickly identify behaviors that feel unjust or selfish. Like, for example, when you're stuck in heavy traffic and a rich dope in the obvious throes of a midlife crisis pulls his yellow Lamborghini into the breakdown lane and whizzes past you. And when we apply contractualism to any of these little free decisions from earlier in this chapter, we will get the answers we'd expect. Would anyone veto a rule that says we should park our car whenever we can in a way that allows other people enough room to park? No. Why would any reasonable person veto that? How about this? We can park wherever we want and everyone else can go to hell. Well, now, yeah, that's definitely getting vetoed. Scanlan isn't trying to turn us into flourishing, virtuous superpeople. He just wants us all, no matter our personalities or religious beliefs or political bents or pizza-topping preferences, to be able to look each other in the eye and justify our basic rules for how to live. That's partly why contractualism appeals to me more than, say, Kantian deontology. Kant wants us to encounter a problem, press pause, enter some kind of magical solitary meditation zone, use our pure reason to discern and describe a universal law that applies to this problem, and then act out of a duty to follow that law. Scanlan just wants us to figure this stuff out with each other, to sit across from one another and ask them, do you agree that this is okay? He puts his faith not in abstract reasoning, but in our necessary relationships with other people. Now, this can seem dicey too, right? I'm guessing that for many of us, leaving our fate in other people's hands doesn't seem like the safest possible bet. It's hard enough to figure out rules for how we ought to live, and now this guy tells us that our choices could be vetoed by Cindy, our next-door neighbor who talks to squirrels like they're people, or by our cousin Derek, who jumped off a diving board into a swimming pool that was frozen solid and broke his tailbone. Perhaps more relevantly, here in 2022, we would be depending on the reasonableness of people with whom we vehemently disagree, like conspiracy theory-spouting Facebook trolls or racist great-uncles. You're telling me those people can reject our rules for permissible behavior? Well, yes, as long as their objections are reasonable and they constrain their own desires to the same degree that we constrain ours. And remember, many of their more extreme views would be rejected by us as unreasonable. As odd and annoying and unpredictable as the people around us can be, given that they're the people we have to live with, I think it's often a better idea to design the moral boundaries of our world with their cooperation than it is to do it abstractly, in their absence. And I further think it's a better idea for them to do so with our cooperation. Okay, I get it. Just tell me if I have to return the damn cart to the rack, please. I'm in a hurry. Again, the previous examples, like where to position our car when we park on the street, are the sort of free decisions where we have to do something, so it's no skin off our backs to do the best version of whatever that thing is. But what about when the decision does cost us something? Some amount of time or effort or energy or sacrifice? Like, say, the question that started this chapter. Should we return our shopping cart to the shopping cart rack? A bunch of new complications make this one, well, more complicated. First of all, the rules of shopping cart replacement have never been clear to me. Are we supposed to bring them back, or is the store cool with us leaving them in the parking lot? Some grocery stores have employees who collect them, which seems to imply that it's okay to leave them near our cars. Or maybe they have to hire those employees because people are selfish jerks and leave carts in the parking lot even though the store would prefer we didn't. Also, maybe it's better to leave them in the parking lot because then people just pop out of their cars and bam, there's a cart right there waiting for them. But then again, sometimes people pop out of their cars and bam, their car door hits a stray shopping cart, which stinks. Plus, we go to the grocery store, approach the door, get a cart from the rack, go shopping, bring it to our car, and then just leave it there? There's something slightly off about that. It seems like we ought to return it. But returning it does require one last little bit of effort on our part to close that loop. One 40-yard jaunt back across the parking lot, the wobbly wheels of the cart grinding unpleasantly on the asphalt while our groceries wilt a little in the hot car, and then a tricky final push as the cart jangles awkwardly back into its stationary nesting doll column, and then, finally, the reverse jaunt 40 yards back to our car, dodging traffic, fumbling with our keys, unlocking the door again, and settling into a seat where we could have been 3 minutes ago in a better mood if we had just decided to tell ethics to screw off. So what would Scanlan say about all this? Well, the rule we're proposing seems something like this. After using a grocery cart, return it to its rack so the next person can use it. No reasonable person rejects that rule, in all likelihood. But what if it's, after using a grocery cart, we should return it to the rack unless the store has a dedicated employee whose job it is to collect carts from the parking lot, in which case it's fine to leave it in the parking lot. That also seems unrejectable. So I guess if there's a dude in a reflective vest wandering around the parking lot gathering carts, we can, in fact, leave ours at the top of our parking space and then just head on home. That action would be allowable. So, is that it? Are we done? Contractualism has a ceiling. It sets in place only the rules that we would all live by if we were each motivated to find a minimum standard for coexistence. Scanlan is looking around at a world full of very different kinds of people, and he's trying to establish certain baselines of behavior that we'll all follow. His theory is designed to stop people from doing something obviously crappy and disagreeable, like stealing the shopping carts, or damaging them so no one else can use them, or getting in one that we find on the street when we're drunk after a wedding and having our friend Nick push us down the sidewalk really fast until we wipe out because Nick is also drunk and loses control and then go tumbling into the street. This, by the way, is purely theoretical. I myself never did this in the year 2005, because if I had, I would have torn a huge hole in the only suit I owned and had to buy a new one for another wedding I had to attend the following month, and that would have been very stupid. And I definitely didn't immediately get up after wiping out and then offer to push Nick in the shopping cart, causing him to also wipe out and bruise his shin. None of that happened. I mean, I was 30 years old in 2005,